Ready to take your verdicts and jury selection to the next level? Jury consultant Harry Plotkin and trial lawyer Dan Kramer are your ticket to tipping the scales before trial begins. You're not just picking a jury, you're picking justice. Produced and powered by Law Pods.
All right, welcome back to another episode of Picking Justice. Harry, what's going on? Is your shirt say mimosas?
Mimosa League, yeah. People actually will ask me if I wear this around. They'll be like, oh, that sounds like an awesome league. Like, how can I join that league? Like, and I'm like, all my shirts are not, they're not real things, dude. They're...
Did you buy that from like Hollister or Abercrombie?
Probably. I went in there for the teen boys cologne and I walked out with the shirt. I was pretty happy with that.
Did it make you start modeling shirtless in the front? Do they still do that?
Make? No, no.
Our guest was probably one of those Abercrombie models back in the day, I bet.
Of course, still am.
And yes, still is. Yeah, I'm definitely not. No one wants to see that. But the Abercrombie and Lancaster ladies, if you ever want to go check out the next great trial lawyer, shirtless, go there. I'm really excited to have my good buddy on today. The only guest we've had whose ass I kicked in an actual debate at a conference one time, the great and up-and-coming trial lawyer, Kale Paris, who has just been crushing it this last year, hit a $58 million slip and fall verdict, and then just tagged LAUSD on a very, very tough case for $7 million. Is that right, Kale?
7.1.
Yeah, amongst many other very tough verdicts. I mean, this guy, I hear a verdict from his law firm, the Paris Law Firm, which is one of the top firms out here in California. And you expect big firms, but then I hear about the facts. Like, he got an $8 or $9 million verdict in Van Nuys where there was no surgery or something, right? Yeah. I mean, it's just, it's really crazy stuff that he's doing. And he's doing a lot of innovative techniques that I think he's learned from many different places, Trial Lawyers College, his dad, Rex Paris, who's, you know, a pretty legendary trial lawyer, and many other places. So we're really excited to have Kale Paris on. How you doing, buddy?
I'm doing good, man. I don't think you've ever said so many nice things.
I know, man.
In one stream. I'm a little confused and taken aback here.
Trust me. I almost threw up in my mouth a couple times as I was saying it, but it's on the cue card, so I have to.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
Once the cameras are off, that ends. Yeah. It's going to turn on you pretty quick.
I didn't mean a goddamn thing I just said, by the way.
I figured.
But no, man, we're excited to have you. Really are. But let's jump into it, dude. Let's start learning how Kale Paris picks a jury. Harry, kick us off.
Yeah, Kale, I'm super excited to hear some things. I've heard that you were one of those guys that just takes the first 12. Just give me the first 12 in the box.
I skip to first 12, no questions.
Yeah, other than asking, get up and say, you can all be fair, right, in the sitting down. Anything else that you...
That's literally been it. I didn't know why you guys wanted me on here. I have one question.
That's it. It's been a great episode. Thank you to Law Pods.
No, but seriously, you are one of the lawyers that I hear all the time. You know, you hear about this amazing result that Kale got, and then you hear like from different people, man, Kale got like, you know, 34 cause challenges and things like that. And the funny thing is, I hear that all the time. And like half the time I hear when somebody does that, it doesn't go well. Yours go well though. So I always tell people, like, there's a right way and a wrong way to get cause. So I really wanted to talk with you today about like, not just how you get cause and like the words that you use and everything. Like, I think a lot of lawyers know that part, but like, how do you like set up the cause? How do you describe the case to jurors in voir dire in a way that you're getting really the bad folks? And what's your kind of like your screening process for like, can you be fair given whatever the facts are?
Yeah, I mean, I think it all starts with the wards mini opening, right? I'm a huge proponent of it. In the last case we just had with LAUSD, the defense lawyers for the first time did a wards mini opening against me.
Wow.
And it is tough to deal with because all your good jurors just start dropping like flies when they do that. But I think the biggest part about it when you're going for cause is to make it at least fun for the jurors. And I think that's where a lot of people I've seen screw up. Like, I have friends who have gotten 50 cause challenges, 60 cause challenges, and then still lose the case. And I wasn't there, but I suspect it had
60? Wait. 60 cause challenges?
Yeah. I used to have the record in Van Nuys with 53, I think is what it was.
Ooh.
And then they beat my record by getting 60.
Well, we are going to talk about that later, but I do want Kale to answer your question. But like these stats on the amount of cause challenges is something we got to be careful our listeners don't take too much to heart. And I want to explain why. But Kale, I want to hear how you make it fun. What do you mean by that?
So like You know, a lot of people use metaphors for cause. Like everybody's heard about, we're starting at the race of a line or a line of a race. Like, don't just do the, are we a little bit further back? Like, I like to get jurors involved with fun little quips about it. Like, I'll ask them, like, do I got a stub toe in this race? And as you get more and more cause challenges, the jurors feel engaged in it and they add things. Like, I had a juror one time tell me, buddy, you're racing without legs. And everybody's kind of laughing about it. And by doing that, I dispel the stereotype they have in their mind of what a lawyer is, because I'm actually a real person and I'm having fun. And it makes the long process of jury selection enjoyable. And I'll do that with a bunch of different things. Like, it's not just the race. It's the, do I have a higher mountain to climb with you? Am I climbing Mount Everest here? Things like that. Those little tiny things that make you seem like a person. And it makes it fun.
So are you introducing these concepts? You know, you hear about the cherry pie stuff, all that. Or are you kind of just starting out explaining biases by using the race analogy and the mountain analogy?
It all depends, right? There's no golden one fast rule in this. But I never used to use the cherry pie analogy because I just don't eat pie, period. And yeah. I couldn't find a good metaphor until recently, because I was, when I was trying the last case, it was the World Series, right? You know, I'm a Dodgers fan. If I were the umpire for the World Series, close calls are going blue. And that actually worked well for me, but I usually don't do that. Usually, if I have a questionnaire, I just go straight at it. First juror that I talk to is, I literally just tell him, hey, Mr. Jones, I read your questionnaire. I know you're not going to have a hard time telling me things I don't want to hear. And your questionnaire scared the hell out of me. Do you mind if I start with you? I think the most important cause challenge is your first cause challenge. So if within that first 5 minutes, you can get somebody who can say, I just can't be fair and really go after you, the waterfall effect is amazing. I mean, you can get a run real quick in the beginning, and then it's just off to the races from there. The first thing is proving through the jurors themselves that they're not going to get arrested. There's no bailiff that's going to take them to jail if they say, I'm not a good juror on this case. And once you make people comfortable with that, then it's really easy to get cause challenges after that.
So what's your mindset going into jury selection? Is it to kind of build the tribe, so to speak? Just get all the bad jurors, get everyone deselection. What's kind of your big picture philosophy on jury selection?
It's both. It's build a tribe with the jurors that are good for me and cause all the bad ones. But which order I go in depends upon the panel and depends upon the judge. So if I've got a judge that's really good for cause, then I'm going to go after cause on all the defense jurors first. But if I got a judge that I know isn't going to give me a cause challenge, even if the jurors say, I definitely cannot be fair with you, then I'm going to start by building a tribe with the jurors that I know are good for me.
Yeah, how do you do that?
Just so you know, this is all based off of, I'm assuming I have a questionnaire. Right? Because most judges in our counties are good with questionnaires. There's only a couple that I run into that say, no, you can't have a questionnaire. But I fight like hell for that questionnaire because it's just such an invaluable tool.
So you're doing a questionnaire on every single trial now?
Every single one. I don't care if it's a 2-day trial. I want a questionnaire.
Like a rear-end car crash you're doing?
Absolutely.
So just quickly, can we talk about how you use your questionnaire? Like what's your method?
Yeah. So when I get the questionnaires, I have a scoring system of 1 through 5. 1 is must get them for cause. 5 is must keep them as best I can. And then there's everything in between. And I have the tort reformer question section is probably the most important. Things like, do you start out thinking claims for emotional distress are exaggerated? Do you think verdicts are too high? I mean, Harry, you probably have a better questionnaire than I do. But that's the most important section, and that's really the section I'm going after. And then the second most important is the background information, because that's kind of how I build the tribe and make it engaging with people. Like even a juror who's bad for me, if I know that they have a job that I can relate to or that I can crack jokes with them about, I start there, then go to the cause stuff. So it's fun. It makes me a real person. Like I like trying cases with other people because I can bring them into it. Like this last case we had, you guys know Alex Wheeler. Guy looks extremely polished. And so I love making jokes at his expense about how he's really not that polished. So like we had somebody who would track Kylie Jenner's Instagram for a job. And I was like, Alex is going to be so excited to talk to you later. And he gets uncomfortable, and it just makes us look more human doing that. And it's fun.
Alex is a great attorney, by the way. Fabulous trial lawyer. So we've never used one together.
Oh, man.
I know.
What I want to ask is, how do you get judges to agree to a questionnaire in a case that doesn't involve, you know, it's not like, doesn't involve super, super sensitive issues. It's like a spinal fusion, you know, rear end collision, whatever, something like that. What is your pitch to the judge?
I mean, I make it seem like I'm going to question these jurors for days if you don't give me a questionnaire. Because, you know, we get liberal probing and there's no arbitrary time limits. And so I really emphasize that. And when they ask me how long it's going to take, I always tell them, Judge, if you don't give me a questionnaire, I'm going to be talking to them for 2 days, 3 days. Give me a questionnaire, I can get it done in one.
Well, so they say, well, no, it's you have an hour, regardless.
And some judges will say that. I just fight as hard as I can. And if a judge won't give me a questionnaire, the next thing that I do is I submit my questionnaire to the judge so the judge asks the questions. I try to make it as difficult as possible for a judge to say no. And I know a lot of the code sections that I can just rattle off to them so that, you know, they know that I'm really pushing for this and I know what I'm talking about and I'm going to make it difficult.
Harry, are you encouraging the lawyers you work with on even those non, like, controversial sex abuse type cases? Are you encouraging them to do questionnaires?
It depends on the case. Most cases, no. The two reasons that I like to use them is, number one, if we have more sensitive issues and things that we don't want necessarily talking about in front of the jury, if there's some bias that we really need to find out that we're worried that the jurors are going to be reluctant to talk about, I'll want a questionnaire. I think all sex abuse cases, you have to have it, because if you don't have it in a sex abuse case, man, you're going to be spending 3 days in chambers just doing, like, you know, sidebar after sidebar. And any judge that says no to it, I'm like, you're going to regret this. And then every time they're like, yeah, I regret this. So the only other time, like, if it's a case where I know a judge is going to give you almost no time for voir dire, then obviously it's like more information. But for me, if you have a judge that is going to give you a fair amount of time, and you don't have any huge issues that you're super, super worried about, I do think that it helps a defense, like it helps a bad defense lawyer more than it helps you, because, like, they can get up there and they don't have to, you know, ask any, they can find out kind of generally who the good jurors are for you without having to do any work. So I really like to bet on myself to assess jurors better than the defense without a questionnaire, but in the right case, for sure. And there's a lot of cases where we do want one, for sure.
I think you make a good point there. That is the trade-off, is the defense gets a lot of information. But the other thing is that you, by doing a questionnaire, you avoid that groupthink responses where people start to realize what the response is that you want to hear and not so much what their actual belief is. Because by the time they've answered the questionnaire, they haven't heard anything from anybody else. Like, you know, when you get towards the end of jury selection and everybody's like, yeah, I don't think that lawsuits are that bad. Like, I think it's okay to sue people. And yeah, no, verdicts aren't too high. Like, it's shocking the number of responses that you will get consistently with people once they've already heard multiple answers.
Yeah, I totally agree. I was picking a jury last month in a trial in Albuquerque where we got a huge verdict. And there was one guy that I struck who, on his questionnaire, there was questions about, how do you feel about lawsuits? And he was this older guy who said, we have an over-litigious society, especially against healthcare companies. And then, you know, the next day in voir dire, he's like, I have no issues at all. No issues with lawsuits or the kind of damages we're asking for. No. And obviously I struck him. But yeah, I mean, in person, he didn't fess up. And you're sitting there scratching your head sometimes with these jurors. Why are you pretending like you didn't write this yesterday in the questionnaire? But you're right. I mean, if we hadn't had a questionnaire, you know, maybe we keep that guy.
So you show up, the panel shows up, they fill out the questionnaire while you wait around. It like takes like 45 minutes or so. And then that night you review them and then you come back and you bring them back the next day to finish jury selection.
It depends on the judge. And that reminds me, going back to the how you get a judge to do it, you also need to make it as easy as possible for the judge. So like at my office, I have 120 clipboards and I have all of the questionnaires ready to go. They're clean. And I have somebody who's there to collect them, distribute them. So it's easy for the judge. But usually a judge will give you the night. Sometimes they don't. Sometimes they just give you the lunch hour, in which case you don't have much time to review them. And so you're going fast.
Whenever they do that, my always thing that I try to push for is like, I don't have an issue with that, except the fact that that gives an advantage to the defendant, because I got to get up and do voir dire first. And so you're giving me an hour to review these before I stand up. And then the defense, meanwhile, gets like 2 hours or 3 hours, however many, you know. And like sometimes that gets them to go, oh, fine, okay, you know.
That's a really good argument.
Are you finding, though, to Harry's kind of point, when you have a questionnaire, are the defense attorney asking better questions, do you think? Are they more probing, or do you think they're more cognizant to get their people off, the bad jurors for them off?
No, what I find is they just go back to the questionnaire and can't come off it. So like anytime they see like something that was bad for them that they think might get them for cause, they get up and they go, now you told the truth when you answered this questionnaire and you said this, isn't that true? And they kind of like try to cross-examine these jurors based on their questionnaire, which doesn't really play very well because I've already prehabbed them by the time I've sat down. Listen, you know, I saw you put this on the questionnaire. We really need fair people here. And I understand we all come in with, you know, a little bit of bias. And it's just the real question is, can you put it aside? And so when the defense lawyer gets up and says, well, you put this on your questionnaire. Yeah, but can you put it aside? Yes, yes, yes. And so it kind of falls flat when they do it that way. I don't see a lot of defense lawyers taking that next step from the questionnaire. They don't ask the follow-up questions. It's almost like they plan like, ah, I got them for cause already. I don't need to plan for anything else. It has an added benefit for me because I'm already thinking that second step ahead and I get to go there before they ever stand up.
So when you have a questionnaire, you reviewed it, you immediately go right to the juror you want to talk to. You don't do like a big, like, do you do a big biases or brutal honesty or any of that kind of pre-intro stuff before you go right in the questions?
No, I'll work that stuff in as I'm talking to them. Because remember, the first juror in my mind is the most important. And so with that first juror, I'll work it in as I think it's needed to get them to say I can't be fair. So like the Dodgers one I was talking about, I worked that in with that first juror. Because, you know, everybody sort of waffles and says, oh, I'll try my hardest. And that's when I work in the jokes like the, you know, if I was getting on an airplane and I talked to the pilot, that one. Or I'll do the, you know, I just recently got married. If I was standing at the altar and they said, can you be faithful? Well, I'll sure try. I probably wouldn't be married. Those things. I work that in all on the first or second juror as needed. I think brutal honesty is great. I've seen it work for a lot of people. I just don't usually use the terms brutal honesty, and it feels weird for me. So I just don't say that. I say a version of it, which is usually like, listen, I've heard every lawyer joke in the book, and I think some of them are funny. You're not going to hurt my feelings. Lay it on me. And as people are like, hesitating or apprehensive to tell me something they think I don't want to hear, I'll be like, don't hold back. Hit me where it hurts. Let's go. And it makes it more personable. It makes it more fun. And in some cases, I've even gotten whole panels to kind of just enjoy kicking the shit out of me. And that's great for me because, boom, cause city on that point. What I found when I get those panels is you inevitably get that sort of tribe building component because there are people who start to feel bad for me. They start to feel bad that everybody's basically talking bad about my case. And they're like, you know, I kind of want to see what he's actually got, you know? And people have come up and apologized to me. They said, I feel like you're like litigating with your hands behind your back. And one of the key things that I always do is I tell them up front, I'm like, just wait till we get to the evidence. I'll explain all of this to you. There's a reason for a lot of what I said. But I just need to know that you'll give me the opportunity to.
That's a huge part of it because sometimes what I see when people getting a ton of cause is like they make their case sound like shit. Mm-hmm. I'm a big believer you never give any of your good facts in your mini opening, but you do have to at least say you're going to hear what this company did, what this driver did, and you're going to hear what this company did, and you're going to hear what they knew about this product before they said, you know, whatever it is. So at least those jurors, the good jurors are sitting there going, I'm not going to prejudge this case. And your bad jurors are like, well, your case sucks because of what I heard you say, the warts and everything. But like, it's super easy to get everybody for cause, frankly, in a case. If all you do is you only talk about your warts and you just kind of make your case sound like shit, you could get all the good jurors. And the hard part, and I think I want to talk to you about how you do this, because I know you do it the right way. I mean, the verdicts speak for themselves, but the hard part with cause is getting only bad people for cause. A lot of lawyers just get, I'm seeing the jurors are getting for cause, and I'm like, some of those are really good jurors. You're just making your, like, who wouldn't raise their hand if all you tell them is like, here's why my case sucks, basically. Like, all the cases I've had, like big verdicts, like I could easily come up with a mini that makes the case sound horrible. So how do you make sure that your good jurors aren't taking the bait and saying, hey, I don't think I could be fair?
Yeah, I save the good jurors. And again, the order depends on what kind of panel I've got and what kind of judge I've got. So if it's mostly good jurors, I start with them and I sacrifice my cause challenges because I know I'm not going to get less cause if I've built all these people to say I can be fair first.
Okay.
And I know that going into it. But if I think I'm going to get a lot of cause challenges, I save the good people for the end. And my goal is to basically make everyone so tired of these cause challenges being granted. And I sort of shift my persona where I'm like, please, please, I'm begging you. We just want a fair case. Can you please be that fair person for us?
Oh, so you're kind of assessing based on the questionnaires who you think is good and who's bad. And you're not asking the good ones like, you know, hey, you're not trying to go after them for cause. You're just like only focusing on the bad people.
I don't talk to them at all until I've finished my cause section.
What do you do if somebody raises their hand and like, you know, Mr. Paris, I kind of feel like this juror over here. And it's like one of your ones that you think is a pretty good juror. Do you sort of do something a little different with them?
I'll hold them in abeyance for a little bit. I won't do the cause killer questions right then and there. I'll wait with them, have more discussion, then come back to them, bring it up. And, you know, you've kind of seen more of the discussions. Like, can you please put it aside? Because if you do it right then and there, one, it looks like you're being tricky.
Right.
But also, two, like, they're more likely to stick with what they've just said. Whereas if you give it time, they might come back with you. And if it's somebody where I know I can't stick them, I can't bring them back, I'll just give them up. And I'll say, listen, we get it. We want a fair jury just as much as everybody does. And you would be unfair for them. So okay. Thank you for telling me that.
Do you use words like abeyance when you talk to jurors?
Oh, Lord, no.
Because I just had to look that up. So I just was curious if that's something you use.
Are you sure you're not from Lancaster, Dan? No, I use as simple as I can. Like when I'm picking a jury, I oftentimes fear that people think I'm really dumb because I crack a lot of dumb jokes and I talk very simple.
But you don't need your jurors knowing you're a smart guy until long into the trial where they kind of figure it out. You know, you got that good jury picked and they're like, wait a minute, this guy knows what he's talking about.
It's a tough balance though, because you don't want them thinking you're an idiot. And like some of the jokes that I'll crack are self-deprecating and sometimes they might get there. And so I'm always thinking about that in the back of my mind.
I mean, I think if you're just yourself, but I mean, using simple words, I think the smartest people use everyday words, right?
Yeah.
So you mentioned this, I think you phrased it as a warts mini opening. I want to explore that a little more because like Harry said, he holds the good facts back. Can you explain a little bit what that looks like?
Yeah, so it's basically introducing the case with everything that I'm concerned about. Any bad fact in the case, the only time it's good for you is in jury selection. So you want to get them as comfortable with your bad facts as possible in your warts mini opening. But a lot of people will just talk about all their bad facts and just leave it there. I say you do a bad fact with a spin, and it's a soft spin, not selling the bad fact, but leaving the suspense there. Like yes. Oftentimes I'll say the bad fact and I'll say, if you're a juror, we'll talk to you more about that, or you'll get to see why that is.
Just to let them know there's another side to the story. I'm not going to tell you what that other side is, but there is one.
Yeah, let's hear kind of an example.
Yeah, so like you'll hear in this case that after this collision, my client went straight back to work the same day. And you're going to hear about why he did that and just leave it there.
Yeah,
exactly.
I agree. You weave it into your story because it is the story, right? I mean, you just weave in the bad facts. You'll hear that, you know, my client went to Hawaii and you'll hear what that trip was like, that kind of stuff. I think you 100% you got to weave.
But the truth is that if you, some lawyers will not even say that second part and they're going to get more causes than you are because if they just say, my client went back to work, he never got a surgery, he, you know, this and that. And you just,
it's
and
all
you're
attorney
not at
referred.
All letting him know. Yeah, you're just laying it out like one after the other, and you're not even letting them know that there is another side to it.
Yeah.
You're going to get a lot of cause, and you're going to get good juror. I mean, if I'm a juror in that case, and I'm like, I can't be fair. Like, I'd be your best juror, and I'd be like, it just sounds like you got nothing. So important. I always teach lawyers, like, when they do that, like, when you have a juror, they can't be fair because of some issue. You got to push back like a little bit. I mean, I wouldn't do it if I know it's a horrible juror. You know, if like you've already seen their questionnaire and you're like, this guy sucks, like, let's get him off. But if we don't have a questionnaire and I'm like, if someone says that, I always say, you got to push back a little by letting them know again, like, okay, you know, they're like, if he went back to work, like, he can't be hurt. Like, and then you say, well, I mean, you're going to hear what it was like. You're going to hear what his doctor, when he did go to the doctor, what the doctor said and what the doctor found. Does that matter to you? Are you telling me he went back to work? I don't care what other evidence is. And if they tell you, yeah, I don't really care, then you're like, okay, good. You're good. You suck. But just letting him know again, because sometimes jurors get confused, right? Like, I had one where we're picking a jury and the defense lawyer totally said something in his mini opening that was like, it was totally bullshit. He was like, Oh, the plaintiff shouldn't have been in this park. And it was totally not true. And so some jurors started to snowball, and jurors were like, well, if he's not supposed to be there, I mean, how is this not his fault? I think I've already decided this case. And the lawyer was just like, I understand how you feel that way. And I'm like, no, don't say that now. And then you start seeing more and more hands are like, wait a minute, that's true. You got to push back and say, well, that's disputed. Are you willing to hear everything? Are you open-minded in case that's not true? Or are you just saying, I've already decided the case? So a little bit of pushback, I think, is important.
I agree with you, but I flip the order. I'll say, so if that one fact is there, you've made up your mind, game over for the plaintiff. And then once I commit them to their cause challenge, then I'll push back and say, well, I'm going to show you that that's not true. But that's what you said. That's your answer. You're sticking to it. So it's a subtle, by pushing back at first, I may lose the cause challenge. Whereas if I sort of lean into it, get the cause challenge, then tell everybody else, nuh-uh, that guy's full of shit. I think I get a better effect. I think I get the cause challenge and get the added benefit of telling them, no, they're wrong.
And I think the concern is that if you do it with just warts, without weaving it, without kind of framing it in a way that is not just your case is shitty, even though you have a really good case, but it's a shitty case, and attorneys are losing good cases that they shouldn't have because they're going too hard on the cause, is really, you know, good jurors being disguised as bad jurors and then attorneys not taking it that extra step to find out, okay, this juror may have said something that an inexperienced attorney may just attack for cause, but they're really a good juror whose mask is a bad juror. So What are the next steps you take to, you're not sure they're saying things that may could get you cause, but they're actually a good juror for you. So what does getting to that next step look like? Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think I get what you're saying. You know, and I'm probably the exception to what you probably should do, but I just think the questionnaire is gospel to a certain extent. I'll go into the why they answered certain questions on the questionnaire. If I don't think they're a bad juror, I think they just got caught up in the warts and are making quick conclusions. I'll go to their questionnaire on like their tort reform answers, see if those still hold true, see if the justification as to why they hold those beliefs are there match in line with a good juror. And even though they said bad things, even if I did get them for cause, I won't actually make the cause challenge.
And that's why you're not the exception. You're not doing it the wrong way, because the warts and everything and getting a lot of cause is great because you weave in the other side of the story and because you kind of target your cause to people that you've already kind of decided based on the questionnaire, like this is a bad juror. And not some of the others. You're doing it right. You're actually targeting it. And that's the whole point that I teach is like, it's got to be targeted. You got to be precise with your cause. You can't just like play the whole jury panel. Yeah. Like people are like, I got rid of the whole jury panel. And you're like, they were all bad for you? All 60 right. of them were bad for you? Like, I find that hard to believe.
Yeah. I always have to remind myself, just because you can doesn't mean you should.
Yeah.
That's the biggest lesson, right? For the people listening. But Harry, I do want to kind of address, you're saying the whole panel, because I think what you're saying is that you hear people say like, who thinks $1 million is too much, regardless of the evidence? You get a bunch of hands up. It doesn't mean they're all going to be bad jurors. And I think this is what Kale's saying. You got to get to that why. Like, Harry, you and I have had that example of the preschool teacher who told me she couldn't award, I don't know, she's like more than $2 million maybe. So that's a cap. I think my thought in that case was to try to go after cause. Harry's like, no, like, let's not. She's waffling. She hasn't decided yet. She's a preschool teacher. She ended up being the jury who wanted to award $20 million, right? And I think that's the mistake that we're talking about is be careful there, because if you just let that first layer, not the why that Kale is talking about, if you don't get to the why, then you're going to lose some good jurors by wiping the whole panel for cause, right?
It's easy, yeah.
And if you have jurors that are just vibing with you, like within 5 minutes, you feel like you're friends with them. That's, I think, also a big consideration. Like, I had a juror one time who told me, I'm not about to make anybody a millionaire. And I kept him on because we were just such good friends in 5 minutes. And throughout the whole trial, like, we had sort of like this unspoken connection, and he was the one that saved me. I mean, it was a seatbelt case, and he got me to $6 million. He wound up being the four person. and he got 0% on a comparative for where my client was not wearing a seatbelt, which is tough to do.
Yeah, but be careful with that too. I mean, you've had people who will smile and then just fuck you. And then I've also had the opposite is where, like, this dude, I remember one time he was this older white guy and he just like scowled at me the whole time. Like, I was like, I am so fucked. Like, he's probably going to be the foreman and all that.
He was pissed you weren't asking for enough money.
Yeah.
Like, he was furious at you.
He was. I wanted to give everything you asked for. It's just like, it's hard to read the tea leaves. I know what you're saying. That's definitely something you have to consider. It's like how you vibe, like, you know, the energy there is definitely important, but it cannot be the end all be all.
No, it's a data point.
Yes.
It is not the final determination. I pick juries with my dad, and my dad can make friends very easily and very quickly. And the number of times I've had to tell him, no, there is no world in which this juror is coming on this. Like, no. But it is a data point. You got to think about it.
All right, let's take a moment to thank our wonderful sponsors who make all this possible. First off is Baldwin Settlements, fantastic structured settlement company with the founder and owner, Melissa Baldwin, who gives back all the time to the plaintiff's bar with CALA, CAOC, AAJ. She really is the go-to structured settlement company in person. Baldwin Settlements, they work with clients to really get them set up for the rest of their lives. I worked with her on the big damages case where he represented someone who was seriously injured, but his demons, he was a drug addict, kind of in and out of homelessness, got him a big settlement. And she was able to speak at his level and convince him that he needed to have a structured settlement to get himself set up for himself and, you know, his siblings who were taking care of him for the rest of his life. And she's just able to really relate to these clients. And not only does she relate well with the clients, she's very accessible. I mean, she will text, call when she's on vacation, nights, weekends, which is what you need with a structured person. She can deal with mediators, the other side's structure person. And she can also get great rates on attorneys for their fees. So I highly recommend Melissa Baldwin, Baldwin Settlements, very dear friend of mine and a huge supporter of the plaintiff's bar. So Baldwin Settlements, thank you for sponsoring.
And for their contact information, just reach out to Dan or I at Picking Justice if you want contact information for any of these folks, because they're amazing. Our other sponsor, Motion Lit, I mean, they do it all. They're technically like a trial technology company, but they do what? Settlement docs. Let me know if I'm missing anything, Dan. Settlement docs, trial technology, animations, graphics. What am I missing here? I'm sure there's a couple other things.
I mean, I've worked with Motion Lit for a very long time. Vahe and Vache, they're wonderful people. They really understand what it takes graphically to tell a plaintiff's story in opening, closing, any imaging you need, animations. We use them a lot for surgery animations because not only are they really good and accurate, they have a great team of animators, but they're also affordable. Frankly, like, their prices are hard to beat. And we've shopped around, you know, but we love Motion Lit. We love their work. Jurors love their animations. So they got all tech support, depositions, like you said, settlement videos. Their animations are fantastic. Just really good people to work with. And they're huge supporters of the Plaintiff's Bar. And I think it's important, the business partners that we team up with, that they support what we do and our causes and all that. And Motion Lit has always been there for that. And they're just really good to work with. And just like Melissa Baldwin, they're very accessible. They're just good dudes. Vahe and Vache from Motion Lit.
And involved in the Altadena fire litigation because they actually lost their office in the Altadena fires. Their office was in Altadena. So get in touch with them for that case or any other trial that you got coming up there at motionlit.com. And they're terrific.
Yeah, no, they're great. And then our final sponsor, who's new to Picking Justice, Four Corners. It is a deposition summary company. We have been using Four Corners in my office for, God, it's probably been 8 years, maybe more. Really just a fantastic company that they will summarize your depositions quickly. We literally, every time we come in a case, because we get a lot of cases referred from other lawyers where depos have been taken, we just immediately, right away, send them all our depos and we get these great, accurate summaries back quickly. And they just make it so easy for any firm, frankly, that is litigating cases, but especially trial firms. If you have a case where you have, you know, 10, 15, 20 depositions, you really need a good summary so you can get up to speed quickly. We love their summaries. I mean, Frank, KTL, this is, I mean, we use them for every single case, all summaries. We trust them with the work. They're quick, they're affordable, just really good, like I said, good people to work with, big supporters of the Plaintiffs Bar as well. So Four Corners, I highly recommend getting all your depots summarized by them, even on cases that you have. As soon as we take a depot, we have a standing order in our office that as soon as the depot's done, as soon as we get the transcript in, my team sends it to Four Corners, gets summarized, and then boom, we are just ready to rock and roll for trial or preparing for other depositions. So Four Corners deposition summaries, fantastic. Harry, you have the contact information for them?
I do. Yeah. If you want contact information for Four Corners and their owner operator, Sheila, who is amazing. Yeah. Reach out to us and we'll get it to you.
All right. Thank you to the sponsors, Baldwin Settlements, Motion Lit, and Four Corners. All right. Let's get back to the show.
What's your feeling, Harry, on vibes? How do you read that? You know, that kind of connection like your attorneys have with jurors?
I think they have to give you some good answers on liability, and they got to be open. I mean, they can't just be a horrible, yeah, they can't be like, I hate lawsuits and companies, you know, doctors, like, you know, shouldn't be second guessed. And you're like, but he's smiling at me, you know, there got to be something there. But I think I do. I mean, I would take into consideration someone is really, I will strike somebody if I feel like, man, this person really seems to just hate the lawyer who's on our side that's doing the voir dire. That's a big deal. It's definitely a point in their favor if they seem to be liking you and listening to you and everything like that. Because I've seen, you know, a good juror can win over a lot of people in the middle. But if they're not in the middle, if they're like, you know, you're not going to win over somebody who's like, this is an F juror, but he loves me.
Yeah.
That's not the person you want to keep.
It's also the nature of how they say the comments. Like with an example I gave, the guy just kind of did it as a joke at the end. I'm not going to make anybody a millionaire. And so they really didn't put a lot of stock in that statement. You know, it wasn't as strong of a data point as...
Same with the preschool teacher. It was the way she said she had a cap, right? She's like...
She clearly hadn't
thought
about it.
Yeah. 2 million, like the way she said that, if she was like, never $2 million, like, you know, very sure, that's very different. The transcript is going to look almost the exact same, but it's the way she said it, the way she like hesitated, you know. I think when people are very convicted in their limit, yeah, it's different.
Harry, I got a question for you.
Sure.
If you don't mind. I mean, I don't want to sabotage your podcast or anything.
No, we appreciate saboteurs on here.
Yeah.
We wouldn't have invited you if we didn't like saboteurs on here.
Yeah, exactly.
Do you ever consider, because this is something that I've been playing with a lot, and everybody looks at me like I'm crazy, but do you ever consider where the juror sits as a component in how you pick them?
Yeah, you know, and Claire, probably even more than me, will notice. She has pointed out, like, she's not like jurors when they come in there and they could just fill in all the rows. And somebody who sits on the end and people have to go over them, she hates those jurors. And we both love jurors who, like, if you ever notice, sometimes there's a juror who, like, waits for everyone else to go out of the box and they hold the door. Mm-hmm. Like, that is a big point for me. It's not like, no, I wouldn't keep that person if everything else they say is terrible. But I do consider that. Or do you mean something along those lines? Or
no.
What do you mean by where they sit? Or a front row versus back row? Or
like, you know, when you're doing a six pack?
Yeah.
How you have some influence on whether or not this good juror sits in seat two or sits in seat six.
Ah, okay.
I think that is one of the most important things. And I spend a lot of time trying, like, I think.
You mean like somebody in the back corner is not going to be as influential as someone like right in the middle with surrounded by other jurors? Is that what you're thinking?
Yeah. Like, I think seats 2, 3, 4, and 5 are the most important seats in the box.
Wait. This is interesting. So just to be clear, and obviously in California, when we say six pack, that usually means you're questioning the first 18 jurors. And they're randomly assigned, but those jurors are just assigned. So
like who they're sitting next to, who they're influencing, that kind of thing.
Yeah. So when you use your peremptories in a six pack or any juror selection, but it's easier in a six pack. If I choose to kick juror number two now, who sits in that seat will be different than if I kick juror number four, then number two.
It would be juror number 14 would go whoever you kick next, right?
Yes.
Well, what Cale's saying is like, if the next juror coming up to fill in that seat is really good, he's going to want them in one of those seats that he likes, right? And if there's someone who stinks, you're like, okay, send him to seat one or seat 12 or something, right? Is that kind of what you're thinking? Yeah.
Exactly.
Explain why you said seats 2, 3, 4, and 5. Okay, why are those the most influential?
So let's say I have a leader who's good for me, right? If they're sitting in seat one, their circle of influence is a total of 3 people. People that they can talk to and interact with when the evidence is going on is seat 2, seat 7, and seat 8. Because they're in that corner.
They're kind of isolated up there, yeah.
They're isolated in that corner. If they're sitting in 2, They have five people that they can reach out and touch. And they have five people who can hear their reactions to the evidence better than like seat one, for example. And so I have a personal belief that if I have a good leader and I can get them in seat two, three, four, or five, it's going to have a significant impact on how others perceive the evidence. And I've seen it happen.
Wow, this is some inside motherfucking baseball right here. Any science to back this up? I don't.
And I wish I did. I've just seen it anecdotally where you get a loud kind of leader who will hear a piece of evidence and will do like the...
Yeah.
And everyone around them who can hear it.
Or they'll turn to look at, like, are you seeing? Oh, they'll look at each other. I mean, exactly. They'll be like, are you?
That 100% happens. No, that during trial, I totally agree with that, Kale. I think that, like, the person in the middle does kind of like other people kind of feed on that reaction or that energy that person's giving off for sure. But I've never thought about how to like control that in jury selection.
It's just the timing of your peremptories.
Right.
Because you know how it goes. Like, once you've gotten done with cause challenges, you see the lay of the land. And you basically say, I have three jurors that I must kick in the current box. And so you just time when you pick them based upon who's coming up.
Wow. Harry, have you ever considered this?
I have picked a jury where I remember where a defense lawyer was like pretty confident. And I'm like, good luck with seats 1, 6, 7, and 12, dude. They're not going to. No, I'm just joking. But no, I mean, I do like it when you have a few jurors who are kind of, I feel like are like-minded and they're all kind of sitting with each other for sure. I've never done that, taking into account, like, where do I want to put this person? Because I always feel like, well, I'd rather my strike order is kind of more geared toward, well, if I think I might be able to pass in a strike or two, you know, I don't want to leave anybody that I can't live with. But if there's somebody I'm like, yeah, I might strike this guy, but I could live with them and potentially pass, I'm going to keep them on. Or if there's somebody that I think the defense may strike that's on my list, obviously save them for the end. And so that's sort of more my order. But it's interesting. I do think, yeah, someone who's up there in seat one is kind of isolated. And
no.
Yeah. I think we should have a listener warning, though, on this advice. I do love it. I think it's like, it's a good idea. I just think it's just one of those things, if you can do it, do it.
It's by no means a golden rule, but for me, it's the second consideration. So I start out saying, I must kick these three jurors. I then look at where they're coming up, like who's on deck. And if I know I've got a bad follower for the defense, I'm going to put them in seat 1, 6, 7, and 12. If I've got a good leader for me, 2, 3, 4, and 5. And the only other thing that I consider is if I've got somebody who I am absolutely vibing with, we are friends, I put them in seat 10 or 11.
Front row by you.
Front row right next to me. Because jurors can hear so much better than lawyers seem to realize. And I'm not the most quiet. I don't know how to whisper in a courtroom for some reason. And I also crack a lot of jokes during trial. And so I want the person that's going to laugh at my jokes close enough to where they can hear me.
Which seat in the box has the clearest view of Alex Wheeler's beautiful face? I mean,
that's 10 and 11.
Is that, do you take that in consideration? It's 10?
It's funny. We actually do.
He does. Listen to him. He has this all mapped out.
It's 10.
No, it's 10. That's the Wheeler face seat.
Because I usually pick the jury when we try a case together. And if I don't have somebody who's like a close friend with me, I'll find some girl who I know thinks Alex is attractive, or guy. And that's where we'll put him at 10 or 11. The other thing about 10 or 11 that's so great, and you know, people think I'm crazy when I say this, and I understand. But the other thing that's so great about 10 or 11 is 10 or 11 can see exactly what the lawyers are doing. And they can see all the way down the row of the tables, at least in most courthouses where it's a 12-seat jury. They can see when you're on your phone. They can see if you have a document on your table. Like, they can see that even though they're not supposed to be looking at that evidence.
The title of this podcast is going to be How to Pick a Jury That Loves Alex Wheeler's Face.
Right? It's not hard, let me tell you.
You said that you have three jurors you want to kick. Is that like your bright line rule?
No, okay. No. I was just using that as a number. It's usually three or four by the time we get done with cause challenges.
And what's your position on passing for cause? First or second round, knowing the defense is going to strike. Do you take that gamble or are you striking?
You mean passing peremptories?
Sorry. I meant passing for peremptories. Yeah.
I'm usually pretty liberal with it. Unless I've got like an insurance adjuster on there, I have no problem right out of the chute. I look at who I cannot live with and who they cannot live with. And if at the end of the day, I'm up, like they have more follower jurors in their favor and I have more leader jurors, I'm passing every time on the first one.
I definitely make use of passing a ton, even if I have a couple of jurors aren't missing my favorites. I mean, if there's someone I can't live with, I never bluff. I'd never pass. If they were to accept the jury, I would never be like, oh shit, I can't believe. Because you know, at the end of the day, like there's always probably going to be one or two jurors you don't love who are followers and everything, and you deal with it. So yeah, if we're way up, if I'm like, man, there's three or four people who I'd be happy with this jury because of the good ones that we have, I'll pass. And I'll pass a couple times. And if they strike some follower next, I'll be like, we'll pass again. I'm going to keep passing until they strike one of these two jurors right here.
Yeah.
And so, and if you've gotten, that's the beauty of cause. Like if you've gotten 20, 30 cause challenges, like you've already used 20 or 30 strikes, essentially. You're not using no strikes. It means, oh, you didn't use any strikes. Like you've already gotten off a ton of the bad ones. So yeah, you should be passing and making them pay for it.
So, Cale, if you have a judge that you know is just not going to grant any cause, maybe one, maybe two, you said you're kind of changing the way you do voir dire. What is kind of the questions you're now asking? And let's assume no questionnaire, because I think a lot of our listeners, probably 90%, are not able to use a questionnaire. So what is your technique then going in?
Yeah, I mean, then it becomes more open-ended discussions. If I know a judge isn't going to give me a fair cause, then I don't really need to root out the biggest cause juror, because it doesn't really matter. I may get one or two, great, but it's just not worth it. So it's more open-ended discussions where I get them to think about sort of the issues that my client's dealing with and put themselves in that scenario. Like we'll use lean care, for example. Has anybody ever been in a scenario where they needed medical care and couldn't get it? Anybody ever have that experience? Can you talk to me about that? That's that sort of building the tribe bit about it. And I won't do necessarily a warts mini opening because I just don't think there's a benefit to it if the judge is not good on cause.
So Cale, I want to talk to you about bringing up lean care and jury selection. Part of my philosophy is I don't want to highlight it too much either, you know, and just make too big of a deal about it. What are your thoughts on bringing it up in jury selection?
I'll be candid with you. I hate trying lean care cases. Absolutely hate it. I try to avoid them like the plague if I can. I would rather have a no surgery case on health insurance than a surgery case on liens. So I'll answer your question as best I can, but I'm probably not the expert on it. I don't like injecting it as though I'm telling them, but I do like having them talk about it. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Like the question that I pose, like, can't get medical care, but you need it. I'll just kind of throw out, you know, has anybody ever heard of a lien? Anybody ever treat on that? Tell me about that. But I will not start trying to sell it.
One thing we talked about in a previous one was, would you ever consider talking to your jurors? If somebody, for example, has never, you know, had a situation where they couldn't get medical care, but what do you think about asking a juror, just picking one and saying, have you ever had a doctor offer to, you know, basically defer payments on a thing and, you know, so that you could afford medical care and everything like that? You know, I never had that. And does that seem something that would be unreasonable to you, or you would reject, or, you know, oh no, that would be great. I mean, you know, just to kind of explain to them what a lien is and getting everyone, all the jurors say, that sounds great. You know, what do you think about, I thought the other day about doing that. And
I like it.
You know, yeah.
I like that a lot, because then, as we've talked about a prior podcast, you can then use that when the defense is attacking your client to talk about the whole class thing and how, you know, they don't want your indigent client to not get treatment because they want them to go to Medicare doctors, not the top surgeon in Beverly Hills, whatever. Yeah. I think you bring that back. I like that question a lot.
The other thing that I just started doing is in California, not a lot of people know this, you can read their answer to the complaint. You just automatically can do it. And this is like law dating back to the 1800s. But no judge has let me do it. Every time they're like, yeah, too bad. So what I've started doing is I send, you know, do you contend that they failed to mitigate their damages? And I have more special interrogatories that spell that out. And then I use their mitigation of damages defense as sort of the basis as to why they treated on a lien, right? They're damned if they do, they're damned if they don't. If they go to a bad doctor and don't get the care that they need, look, they failed to mitigate their damages. If they go to the good doctor on a lien, look, this guy's just a paid hack. It's a no-win scenario for them.
Yeah, I like that a lot. So the questions you ask in discovery are what?
Whatever their answer says. I literally quote their answer because I can read a special interrogatory. I can also read the answer, but judges seem to feel weird about that. And then I'll spell it out with more things like, are you contending in this case that they failed to mitigate their damages by not seeking medical care? Things like that.
I like that. So what I always like to ask is, what's your philosophy on bringing up money early, meaning before opening? Do you, in your mini opening, or are you saying, I'm asking for $47,900,000? Are you saying many millions, tens of millions? Are you not even touching it? What's your philosophy and when do you do it?
Always touch it, and always touch it as soon as possible.
And what is touch it? Like, explain that.
Do you mean a specific dollar amount or?
Well, yeah, like do specific or do you do many millions?
No, so I do a range and I used to do a specific number. I used to do it. I stopped doing it in that no surgery case that you mentioned, because in that case, I don't know why I said it this way, but I did. I said $10, $20, $30 million. I'm going to be asking for non-economic damages in the amount of $10, $20, $30 million. And I talked to them afterwards when they were deliberated, after they deliberated, and they said they started out by saying, who here believes this is a $30 million case? No hands went up. Who thinks it's a $20 million? No hands went up. Who thinks it's a $10 million? 11 hands went up. And ever since then, I've stuck with that. And it gives me wiggle room, right? Like, the evidence doesn't come in well, I'll go towards the low end of whatever range I said I would do. If it comes in really well, I'll go towards the high end.
So why not just say tens of millions?
The only reason I don't like it is because it feels weak to me. It feels like I'm scared to talk about it. It feels like I don't feel confident telling you exactly how much. And I'll even tell them when I give the number, I don't want to shock you with this. It's a lot of money. I'm asking you for $10, $20, $30 million at the end of this. And I need to know if you're good with signing your name to something.
What did you do in the 50, what was it, 58, 55?
So the judge wouldn't let us ask for a number.
Any number.
Any number. And I fought like hell for it. And she,
not even million. Could you say millions of dollars? Many millions?
No.
Okay. Well, how'd you handle that?
So I made her a little uncomfortable, but what I said was, have any of you ever seen those billboards for verdicts where it's $20, $30, $40 million? When you see that, do you automatically think, whoa, that's ridiculous?
She didn't shut that down?
She didn't shut it down.
I love that.
I'm not telling them what I'm asking for, but I'm getting the number out there. And, you know, no defense lawyer has done the motion in limine on it. And no judge has said you can't say any number at all, period, regardless of the context.
Because I am noticing more and more, Harry, you have more experience than I, but judges are starting to not even let you talk about millions. I'm getting that kind of, that seems to be, I don't know if that's what they're all talking about or they're saying that at conferences, but no, I mean, I fight like hell too, man. I go balls to the wall and motions in limine. I argue like hell, like, you know, Your Honor, we have to be able to do this. I mean, this is a buy-in, all that stuff.
And you cite the case law that says that you can, and they're like, I don't care.
I know, man. It's crazy.
Because they know that I have not yet seen a case. I mean, you guys correct me if you've seen one where a verdict got overturned on something that the judge did in jury selection. It's like never.
Yeah.
Like, so they know it. They know, like, they probably could give you five peremptories and say, I'm only going to give you five, and they probably could be upheld on appeal because it's not, well, you can't prove that it would have impacted. And I've seen judges, yeah, things that they don't like, you know, like for the mini opening in California, it's mandatory, but I've seen judges, you know, say, you got 30 seconds to do it. I saw one judge do that. Or you got to submit it in writing and give it to the other side and it's got to be approved and everything. And so they're finding ways to kind of get around these things.
Yeah. In writing, I actually got upheld in the 5th district, which—
Oh, did it?
What happens in the 5th should stay in the 5th. But
yeah.
Whatever. There was actually a poll done on, and it was an unofficial poll, and I'm not going to tell you how I know about it because I can't. But 51% of judges in LA County are not allowing people to ask for numbers in jury selection.
Wow.
Assuming you're not. So is it the first time you've tried the billboard thing? Was that one time or have you tried that?
Done it 4 times now.
And has a judge been like, counsel, I told you, don't talk about money?
I've never had a, you got to understand it's the lead up to it, right? So I start out talking about, I say large verdicts. And I'll say, has anybody ever seen like large verdicts in like newspaper articles? And by just reading the title alone, without seeing any of the facts about what happened in the case, thought, oh, that's a ridiculous number. And I'll do that with the first juror. And then the second juror, I'll talk about the news articles and then go into billboards. Like, you've seen billboards where, you know, it's like $20, $30, $40 million on the billboard. And you think to yourself, gosh, that's so much money. No way would I ever sign my name to that. And so it's sort of a slow step.
Yeah, you can't come out right away.
No, you can't come straight out of the gate with it. You got to get them comfortable with each slow step. And then by the time it happens, they definitely perk up when you say the number. But I've never had them say, no, you can't do that. You know, I've only had an objection once when I did it.
So if the judge says you can't talk about millions of dollars, but you can say large or substantial verdict, tell us how you're setting that up in your mini opening.
What I'll do is I always try to get the economic number, and sometimes they won't let me do that. But I always try to get the life. Oh, man. I don't know.
Not even the economic number. Wow.
Right? Which is crazy because that's what the evidence is going to be. But yeah, no. So judge the $58 million, she wouldn't let me do an economic number either, which I screwed up on the argument on that. So it wasn't entirely her fault.
You know what you should do? Just say, you know, you're going to hear that the life care plan or that, you know, whatever the amount of medical care is. And then just turn to the defense lawyer and say, is it okay? Do you mind if I tell them?
That's a good one. That's good.
No, you know, that'd be great.
Well, okay. But let's assume you're shut down. And I think this is very educational, you know, so all you can do, you're going to ultimately ask for somewhere between, you know, eight figures, 10 and 50 million, somewhere in that range. So what do you do to find out who are the bad jurors and to anchor it high if you can?
If I can do the economic number, I'll say, you know, the life, you're going to hear that the future medical expenses are going to be to the tune of $7 million. And the bigger part of this is we're going to talk about the non-economic.
Okay, that's an easy one, dude. We don't all have $7 million economic cases here. Let's talk about...
Well, hold on. Because that's not fair. Because you have to build a life care plan. And that's one of the most frustrating things that I see with people. Like, I'll get these cases where it's a brain bleed and it's a $2 million life care plan. Like, I spend a lot of time with my life care planner, arguing with them, fighting for my client's future medical care. There's not a case, even like a single level fusion disc bulge. I think that's a $4 million life care plan every single time. It is not all adjacent segment disc disease, one adjacent level fusion, and we're done with it. I wholeheartedly disagree that not all of us can get major life care plans. You just need to put in the time and argue and fight for your client for it. The standard is what they're reasonably certain to need in the future. But what is the definition of what reasonably certain is? My definition is if it'll make them 0.1% better, they get it, full stop. But the other argument that I have is what is reasonable in the sense of what can we actually sell? I don't put pillows in my life care plans. I don't let doctors do that. A gym membership, are you kidding me? We should all go to the gym. But no, I mean, if there's regenerative injections that they should get on a monthly basis, I don't care how much they cost. Why shouldn't they get it? We're trying to get them back to where they were before. I don't mean to go off on you as much as I am.
No, dude, this is great. I'm going to email my team of lawyers, be like, start arguing with our life care planners.
Oh, yeah.
No, I like that a lot. That's good advice.
I've tried hiring new life care planners, and the ones that tell me, no, that's my opinion, full stop, I never work with them again. Because medical care decisions are not made by one person. At a minimum, they must be two, because the client gets a say. And so I fight very hard. We have a phone call before the life care plan is done. We discuss it. And anything that I think, like if it's a gym membership, I'm like, come on, man, why lose credibility? Everybody should get a gym membership. But if it's like real things like PRP injections or like early onset dementia is a big one, I'm fighting for it. And we should put it in. If it's a big ticket item that will make them 0.1% better, it's going in. That we can actually sell. And, you know, most of the defense doctors will agree, like, if it can make them a little bit better, do you think that they should have the opportunity to use it? So how do you get around that?
That's good stuff. Okay. That's probably for another podcast called Picking Life Care Plans.
Can we have you on again where you just, like, cross-examine a life care planner and...
If Kramer gives me that same intro again, then yeah, definitely.
Yes, okay.
No, don't worry. I can't. I'm already sick to my stomach that I even did that. So hypothetically, you got waiving meds or just straight general damages case. What are you doing there where you're trying to anchor?
Yeah, so I still do the billboard thing, but in mini opening, like I just use a lot of adjectives. I'll be like, listen, this is a big case. We really need your help. And the more people in the courtroom, the better. I love having 14 people in there. They've got a tech guy, I've got a tech guy, they've got three lawyers, I've got three lawyers. Because that, I'll use that and I'll say, as you can see with how many people are sitting in here, this is a big case. As you can see, this is a 5-week trial. This is a big case. There's a lot going on here and we need your help to get a fair result, no matter how big it is. Things like that.
Okay, I like that. But I want to follow up a little more, but what are your thoughts, Harry, on having a lot of like people at plaintiff counsel table? I remember one time we tried a case and there was like my referring attorney, there's like three attorneys and then you were trying to sit and it was like, wow, that's a lot of people. I don't know.
Yeah. You know, I don't have the strongest opinion about it. I mean, I do like it when the defense has way more than we do. I don't love it when there's, you know, three or four of us and maybe only one of them. That looks bad. Although in that particular case, I think you're thinking about Santa Monica. you know, it was what it was, but yeah, exactly. with who the defense attorney was.
Yeah.
But anyway, because if the defense gives you that gift of sending like a million people, like take it and maybe have a little bit less or whatever, it'd make them look bad. I remember one, I was picking a jury where literally they had three different law firms. And I think there were 14 defense lawyers at like sitting at like two or three tables. And the jury selection is just me and the one lawyer. And then after jury selection, it was just the one lawyer. And they had way more in the back. It was crazy. And the jurors were like talking about it. Yeah.
In that case in Santa Monica, we had some jurors like come and be like, you guys are in your nice suits. Like, let's just say the defense attorney was like probably 5'6", but wearing the same size suit I wear. And I'm 6'4".
So I think I might know who you're talking
about. Yes, yeah, I'm sure you do. And it was just him. And I was like, oh man, this probably doesn't look great. But hey, we got that juror off for cause, honestly. He was a terrible juror.
Yeah, exactly.
Us.
Yeah, whatever helps, man.
What do you think, kid? Does it matter or not at all? What do you think?
I agree. If it's just one defense lawyer, probably thin your herd a little bit.
Especially the one, that we're talking about.
Yeah, especially him, because he'll play the, oh, poor little me, I'm the under guy.
Yeah.
Underdog. But if they have five people, I want five people. Or I'll even go with six. I think the more people in that room, the better, because it just makes it look big.
So just going back, and we're going to wrap soon. This is great stuff. But so you kind of say this is a big case. We're asking for a substantial amount. Large verdict. That's just the best you can do, I guess, right? In that situation.
In the mini opening, and then you do the billboards.
And then you do the billboards.
Because the billboards gets you your number. I'll tell you, every single time, jurors think that's exactly what I'm asking for. You know, they start saying, I mean, if you're asking for $10, $20, $30 million, I can't do that.
Yeah.
I don't correct them. And that's where the judge will start to get a little pissy with me, because I got my intended effect that they were trying to avoid without them even realizing what I was doing.
Yeah.
But I don't correct them. I just say, yeah, I mean, if that's the case, can you do that?
Yeah.
That's the only way I've been able to figure out how to get there. You know, I tried doing like Oprah's house costs this much and it never works for me.
The billboard thing is kind of, it's too layered, right? Because you find out who are the jurors that think that this is like an ambulance chaser billboard case. Then you're also getting the numbers out there. So you're going to get that double whammy on those bad jurors.
Yeah. And you have to say an amount if you do the billboard thing. Because I've tried the billboard thing without an amount and you wind up low anchoring yourself. And I didn't think this through when I did it, but they see the Instagram and Facebook ads where it's like, oh, they got me a $100,000 check.
Yeah, exactly.
And that happened to me one time and I was like, oh shit, this backfired. This backfired so bad. And I had to like scramble to move it. But just make certain you say the amount.
Yeah, you're usually not getting the person that just is happy and walking out of their car saying, this attorney got me $50 million. Uh-huh. Usually that person's not able to do that.
Yeah.
It's not really, I shouldn't laugh at that. But anyway, well, this has been great, bro. Really appreciate it. Harry, any final thoughts?
Wow, there's a lot to think about. But yeah, no, I think the thing for me that is like, you know, making sure that you're doing all the things you need to do when you're getting a lot of cause. And it's so awesome when you go in there, and especially with the hospital. I'm sure, Kale, you've gotten probably more than most judges ever expected they were going to give you.
Yeah.
But making sure you get the right ones and making sure you're doing all those things, like, you know, you're showing them that there is another side. Because, man, one of the best things I love about underselling the case a little bit in mini opening and jury selection is like, and I'm sure you say this, Kale, is like, then the good jurors who are, I'm willing to listen to the other side, but they're like a little skeptical. Then they hear how good your case is and they're like, holy shit, you know, why didn't you tell me? And you're like, well, you know, if I had told you, you wouldn't be on the jury. So just make sure that you're finding ways to keep those people and not just, you know, getting rid of everybody. And if you see it start snowballing in the courtroom, I've seen it. You got to once in a while, just push back and go, you understand that's disputed and everything. So, but if you're doing it that way, man, I'm thrilled when you get 20, 30, 40, 50 cause challenges, because some cases you need them, man.
Yeah.
Some venues. Are all your clients on meth? Is that a requirement to represent
90%,
them?
90%. I mean,
Arsh Hamanpour, I think you have to be on. He won't represent you if you're not on meth. So
he drug tested you before he signed you.
It's just too
up.
Easy for him otherwise. He's like, that's not a challenge. So,
right. Yeah. Well, hey, man, we're going to have to bring you back for volume two. This is great. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun.
Thanks a lot. Kale Paris, the Paris firm. Really top-notch trial lawyers trying cases throughout the state, right? Country? Are you guys nationwide now?
Yeah, I mean, we don't have offices nationwide, but we try them around the country.
Thank you all for listening. Thanks again to Law Pods and all of our sponsors who make this possible to get out there and help anyone who struggles to pick a jury, because we all do. It's the hardest thing to do in trial, and we're here to help. We're all learning a lot. We're learning together, learning from our own mistakes. So thank you for tuning in. We got some big names coming up. Joe Fried, Arsh Hamanpour, the rallies. The list goes on and on, but we're really excited. Thank you. And for Harry Plotkin and myself, this is Picking Justice.
If you're enjoying the podcast, the best compliment you can give us is sharing it with a colleague who would find it valuable. For all the best clips from the podcast, follow us on social media. You can find those links in the show notes. Have a jury selection story to share? Email us at podcast@pickingjustice.com and we may address it in a future episode. Until next time, remember, you're not just picking a jury, you're picking justice. Produced and powered by Law Pods.